So thanks for joining us again. We began last week talking about the root concept of distinction that you can see in pretty much everything that is that falls under the umbrella of holiness. And then we listed, I don't know, a dozen words or something like that that fall into a similar category. And we noticed the concept first appearing in Genesis 2 with the Sabbath, and then again in Exodus. And then we talked about the call that we have to be a holy people as Christians. And then we finished by talking some about God's holiness. And near the end, I mentioned Isaiah 6, and that's where I want to spend our time tonight. There was even more here than I thought the more time I spent with it. So I hope it'll be as helpful for you as it was for me. I think this is going to be something useful to cover near the beginning of the quarter and something that we can draw on and reference as we go further. But I will tell you, I'm just slightly anxious about this class because this is deeper waters that I normally splash around in, so we'll see what we can make of it. But I trust that y'all will help me out whenever we start to get into trouble. So, and I've given tonight's lesson this title, although at some point we'll reveal that that's actually a misnomer, but I couldn't come up with anything better. So Isaiah 6. The first five chapters of the book are sort of a prologue, and then we get to chapter 6, which is where Isaiah actually gets his call to be a prophet, and we get this story recounted. And, you know, in that prologue, we get some of the basic ideas that will thread their way through the rest of Isaiah, and 6 reaches back to some of that stuff, but we don't have to go grab too much of that just to get what we need out of chapter 6 here. So can I get somebody to read for us? Get us started by reading the first 5 verses. So Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 5, please. Whoever's got it, whenever you're ready, take off.
In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had 6 wings. With two he covered his face, and with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts."
Thank you, Dale. So how is God described in this passage? Let's look at the different ways. What do you see? How is God described here?
Sitting on a throne.
He's sitting on a throne. What does that tell us?
King.
He's king. Okay, what else?
Has all authority.
And authority, yes, good. What else?
The train of his robe.
What do you think that's about? It's an interesting picture, but
I heard the example of like Princess Diana and how long her train was, and that you just look at it, it was humongous. It filled everything, and it was like that was majesty back then, and honor and all that stuff.
Royal and majestic,
royal, yes,
too. And it's also a little, you know, that the train of his robe fills the temple. It's not just he has a long one. It fills the temple, which does, you know, denote the size and grandeur of all that. But you could also see that, too, as, you know, this God isn't constrained by a temple. Just the fringe of his robe is enough to fill up the temple where his name sits. He himself, how much grander is he? Good. What else do you see? How else is God described here?
High and lifted up.
High and lifted up. What other words do you have there?
Exalted.
Lofty. That's probably it. I'm not sure if there's anything else. How does that connect to his holiness?
It's an extra level of separation.
Ah, yeah. Good. Okay, what else do you see?
He's surrounded by the seraphim.
He's surrounded by the seraphim. I guess some of y'all were in Jeff's spiritual beings class and know more about that than I do. But we actually will say more about them later. They'll be useful to us near the end. Anything else?
He's the only one ever described as holy, holy, holy.
Yeah.
Not just one holy, but three.
Mm-hmm. And we're pretty familiar with that, you know, the song, but then it comes up again in Revelation too. And I actually learned something new about that as I was reading today, so I'm hoping it's right. But that in Hebrew, whenever you wanted to, you know, add a superlative to something, like say it's very something, you said the word twice. So in our English Bibles, when we see like fine gold in Hebrew, and I checked in my interlinear thing, it's just gold. So it's the goldest gold there is, right? And so you say it twice. Well, God's not just holy, holy. He's holy, holy, holy. So it's not holy to the power of two. Now it's to three. It's, I mean, we're on an order of magnitude different than anything else there ever is. He's the holiest of holiest of holy.
Same perfect holiness, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Just beyond what we can imagine. And is there anything else that you see?
The earth is full of His glory.
Yeah, the earth is full of His glory. So, do you see how even in the things that, you know, don't include the word holy, but they can still connect to it, that He's just holy with a W, other, and different and above and exalted and glorious and royal, and the picture is just of, you know, amazing majesty of perfect holiness. And so this scene opens like this, and then, you know, we get this call, this praise from the seraphim. But what happens next? That's just sort of the picture. You know, if you're imagining this as a vision, you see this and you see it in a split second, and you need long enough to hear the seraphim say those two lines. What happens next?
Starts trembling and smoking.
Fire and shaking. What specifically is shaking?
Foundations.
The foundations of the doorposts. Now, we'll say more about that in a sec. And then that the temple began filling with smoke too. But that, you know, that's pretty standard language for when God is present and things are going on. But I think there's, at least from some of the people that I read, and it seems convincing, it seems that there's more that we can do with it than that. So what happens as the shaking and the smoke begins? Yes, God is speaking, and that's when we get this. Or there is speaking, I suppose. What happens next after that? So
Isaiah panics.
Isaiah panics, right? Why does Isaiah panic?
Well, it's kind of interesting because Isaiah is, I mean, we all look at Isaiah as he's like kind of up there. Right?
Yeah.
And he's looking at himself in the presence of God as like, oh my goodness, I have no business being here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it sort of helps get an idea of just the majesty that God is representing.
Absolutely. So why was Isaiah in trouble? What was the what did he realize that scared him?
He's
a man of unclean lips, and why does that pose a problem here? We're in the presence of the holy to the power of three, right? And that can't work. And remember that, you know, he says that he's a man of unclean lips. That falls into the same, you know, area as holiness. And so now we're beginning to see what happens when unholy and holy start to get too close to each other. So now that we're clear about the problem, the doorposts, the foundation of the doorposts are shaking and smoke is coming out. Can you put those pieces together? Think about what doors are for and what smoke does. And then what Isaiah realized as that was happening.
Threshold to enter God's presence is a door.
Right.
And the smoke, it can either refine something or hide it.
Right. So smoke hides, right? And the doorway is, you know, where you go in. So the thing that holds up the door is shaking and smoke is beginning to enter. What's happening?
He's not being able to see with God's seeing
anything. He's beginning to be kept out. You see that? Do you buy that? So part, and so maybe that's the reason Isaiah begins or has this realization. See, I mean, surely it's because of the greatness of God, but then as soon as he sees this, it's trembling in smoke. He's beginning to be cut off from it. And so this is where we need to stop and talk about what's on the board. What do we learn about what happens when holy and unholy meet? It can't. What?
It's like oil and water.
Yeah, they don't mix.
They don't merge.
Right. So it's really not the case that unholy and holy ever meet, because they can't. So that's why I said that that's sort of a misnomer. I didn't sit and all to figure out a better label. But in this case, the unholy would not come into God's presence. And part of this is, you know, Isaiah knew his stuff, and he would know that, you know, you can't see God and live, and part of that is, you know, limits of humanity, but part of that was, I'm a man of unclean lips and I'm coming before God. This won't work out well for me.
Well, it's a bit of a separation.
Right.
And Isaiah goes on to say later, chapter 59, that your iniquities separate you from God.
Right. That's the same idea, the iniquity, the uncleanness, the stuff like that. And so, when these two things get too close together, one or the other will always give. It doesn't always work the direction you think, but we'll clarify that more in a minute. So, let's look in a few other places. Exodus 19 is another place where we see this. We went here last week, and we're back here again. Exodus 19 is when God comes down on Mount Sinai and begins to enter into the covenant with the people of Israel. Could I get somebody to read for us Exodus 19, verses 10 through 13?
And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, 'Be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they approach the mountain.'"
Thank you, Cole. Where do you see holiness in this? Or where do you see this idea? We don't see that language.
Consecration?
We do have some of the close language of consecration, being set apart, cleaned up. Good.
The building of a barrier around to keep separation.
Yeah. Ready.
God being up on top of Mount Sinai, the people being down at the valley level. Distance and separation.
Mm-hmm. Distance in both ways, too.
Well, if you've gone back a verse or two, and it's also been later.
Right.
I mean, he says he's coming in a thick cloud. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be, they're going to hear his voice, but they're not going to see him, because the cloud, so similar to the smoke
in
the temple, is going to prevent them from seeing, because just hearing the voice is frightening enough.
Right. How well?
Not sure that this is right along with what you're talking about, but the interesting thing here about this passage versus the other one is God gets very descriptive about the unclean individual that would come in contact with the mountain and what that person will have done to him. So when you compare that back over to what Isaiah was thinking, you can kind of see why he was a little bit shaken up there.
Right.
Because out of God's own words in Exodus, he said anybody that comes on this mountain is going to be shot with an arrow or stoned to death.
Mm-hmm.
So Isaiah, you got to believe that was kind of running in the back of his head, like, what in the world am I doing here?
Absolutely. Anyone else?
knowledge and don't touch them, that nobody else is allowed to touch them. I don't know if that's to stop them, and so then they become unholy.
I think it's because that person's touched the mountain and tried to mix. God is saying you are not to then try to mix yourself with it, because they've, you know, it's, I guess, I mean, continuation of the holiness. So stay away from it.
I think that's part of it, too, that, you know, that's why, you know, you have to stone them or shoot them with an arrow. You can't touch them because they've touched the mountain that has become holy because the holy God is on it, and now they've contracted the holiness, I guess, and it'll just continue spreading if you keep touching and doing, so you have to stay back. You can't even touch the body. And even the animals, right. So, it's serious business, and some of this could seem odd, but then as soon as you look at it through the with the picture of holiness, well, okay, it makes a little more sense why we got to keep this strict barrier. You can't touch anything that touches the mountain, and all that becomes a little bit clearer. There's another place, too, where we see something similar in way back in this little bitty book called Haggai. In Haggai 2, we see another instance where this idea comes up. Can I get somebody to read chapter 2, verses 11 through 14? Haggai 2, 11 through 14.
This is what the Lord of the army says. Ask a priest for a ruling. If a man is carrying consecrated meat in the fold of his garment, and a touch of bread, stew, wine, oil, or any other food, does it become holy? The priest answered, no. Then wait. So when did he answer?
2:14.
Then Haggai asked, if someone defiled by contact with a corpse, touching any of these, does it become defiled? The priest answered, it becomes defiled. Then Haggai replied, so this is the people, and so this is the nation before me. This is the Lord's declaration, and so it is, and so is every work of their hands, even when they offer, there is defiled.
Right, and so God's indictment continues from there, but the piece that we needed, he gives us right at the beginning. He does his Q&A with the prophets. How does holiness and uncleanness work here?
Well, if it was holy, when it touches something unholy, it's no longer holy.
Right. So it's the other way around as it was from Exodus, right? The unclean spreads to the holy, but not the other way. Do you see that? If you're carrying holy food and touch something unclean, everything's unclean now. But if you're carrying unclean stuff and it touches the holy, well, yeah, it's. I mean, everything's unclean. It doesn't work the other way. So that one's quick. But then, how do you think this worked out when God comes in the flesh?
When God came to see Moses on the burning bush, he said, take your sandals off because you're on holy ground.
We're coming there. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. So when God comes in the flesh as Jesus, things get a little, could get a little confusing.
He touches unclean things all
the
time.
So Mark 5.
Things touch him.
I had not really read, I had read these stories plenty of times before, but I had not read them with an eye on laws about being clean and unclean. But when you do that, things get a little more interesting. So, Mark 5, the section we need begins at verse 21 or 22, a synagogue official named Jairus comes up and asks him to come heal his daughter. And then can I get somebody to read verses 25 through 34.
And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had. and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus, and came up behind him in the crowd, and touched his garment. For she said, "If I touch even his garments, I will be made well." And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And, sorry, what verse? 34?
Yeah.
And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing around you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease."
Yeah, thank you, Joel. So, would this woman have been clean or unclean?
Unclean.
Unclean. And so, if she touched another person, what would that person then be?
Unclean.
Unclean. So, did Jesus become unclean?
No.
No. What happened?
He healed her.
The uncleanness, the thing that was making her unclean, is suddenly gone now. But we know that there's some limits on that because she had faith to make it happen. That, you know, every person that ever touched him wasn't suddenly, you know, clean inherently. And then think about the story that follows this too. So while this scene happens with the woman who has the flow of blood, they come and tell Jairus that her daughter has died and to leave Jesus alone, right? And then he goes, and he gets laughed at because he says that she's sleeping, she's not dead. He went into the child room where the child was, 41. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old, and immediately they were completely astounded. Did you see it there again in that story too? Remember that dead bodies were
unclean.
And you would become unclean if you touched them. And Jeff has... I'm going to attempt to do this here because I didn't think it through. But think about... Jeff has described death as the ultimate uncleanness before to me. And it sort of makes sense because that's the curse that sin, unholiness, brought in. It's the epitome of what uncleanness leads to, right? And so... like, you know, the high priests couldn't, you know, go bury his own parents, right? They're the people that come into the presence of God, well, because they couldn't do anything with death, because death was sort of the ultimate uncleanness. And so this girl is as unclean as could be because she's as dead as could be, and yet Jesus touching her does not become unclean himself. She comes back to life. The thing that made her unclean was removed. And so in some cases we see that when the holy and the unholy met, they both become unholy. But in some cases, they both become holy. So what makes the difference? Dale?
So the places where they become unholy is where it's something man has done to set it apart for God.
Mm-hmm.
But it's man doing it and something else touching that. Whereas when it's God and Jesus being God, they can make anything holy. You know, they can't be in the presence of the unholy, so it's got to be
right.
Well, God and Jesus are inherently holy. Everything else is only holy because it's been made holy in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
And so that's the difference, is God can make anything holy,
mm-hmm.
but anything I make holy, it's only because God said you got to follow certain rules, and if I don't follow those rules exactly, what I tried to make holy becomes unholy.
Right. Randy?
So this is a little confusing, okay? Because what we saw in Isaiah is God shielded himself
mm-hmm.
from the holy unholiness.
Right.
The example we have here with Jesus is his holiness overpowered the unholiness. I don't mm-hmm. know any other way to describe it. And made whatever came in contact with him holy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not sure he shielded himself.
Well,
I think he shielded Isaiah from... what could have happened.
Well, the way that it's described, though, about, you know, the pillars shaking mm-hmm. and the smoke coming in, Isaiah had nothing to do with that. That was God doing that.
No, I understand that, but I'm saying it kept Isaiah out of his presence.
This will probably resolve itself as we continue.
Okay. Here we go.
If it doesn't, we'll come back, but I would guess that it will. And so we see that, well, like what John was saying with, you know, this is how you know which way it's going to go, because God can't become unholy, because God is holy, you know, almost in a definitional sense. That can't change about him. So if something unholy is going to come before God, it will either be destroyed or cleanse. There are two choices. It's either clean it up and make it able to come before God, or get rid of it, because it can't. So the unholy and the holy will never truly meet. Something's going to give. And when you're dealing with God, it will not be God who gives. And so that's why we see that we looked at last week, the writer of Hebrews say that we have to strive for the holiness without which no one will see God. If you don't have this, you can't come in. You know, it's like magnets repelling each other. There's no way to make them touch. Go ahead.
When you go back to Isaiah 5:40, where the girl was dead and he went, and it said, and they ridiculed him, but when he had put them all outside,
mm-hmm.
he took the father and the mother and all those of the child and those who were with him, they went in, and the child got up. But all those that were lacked of a scorn, that were without faith,
mm-hmm.
he told them, stay out. You stay outside.
Yeah.
They couldn't go in. And it occurred when those that believed went in, but the others stayed out. It was like they could not miss.
Mm-hmm. That's a neat observation. Thank you. So, thinking back towards Isaiah 6, because there is more that we need to get there, this scene demonstrates, you know, this part of the concept of holiness, that unholy and holy aren't going to come together. And yet, this was an interesting observation someone had made that I was reading earlier today, that the specifics here in Isaiah 6 are things that we would probably not consider to be serious infractions. Because Isaiah had just seen God. He didn't, you know, come try and shake his hand or sit on his lap or whatever. He had seen God from afar. And Isaiah's fear about uncleanness had to do with what?
His lips.
So, you know, perhaps there were other things that he had done, but the uncleanness that worried him had to do with what he had said, really. And yet, it's easy. Looking at somebody and saying the wrong thing don't always loom large in our head, and yet it was large enough here to go, woe is me, I'm undone. You see that? And so, you know, it's not just with the big stuff, this matters all the way down, that the holiness and unholiness isn't, you know, doesn't consider how big we think the sin is. It can be a misspoken word. But let's keep reading in Isaiah 6. Can I get somebody to read for us Isaiah chapter 6, verse 6 through 8?
Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. And he touched my mouth with it, and he said, behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, send me.
Thank you. So what was the solution for Isaiah's problem?
Forgiveness.
Who initiated that?
God.
The seraphim.
The seraphim upon God's authority, right. Surely. Went and did this thing. How did it happen? How was Isaiah made clean?
Well, he had to first recognize that he
had sinned. He first repented, I guess, and said, I'm an unclean man. I can't be here. He recognized that.
Right. The realization came first.
And then there came the salvation after that. And
right.
And then his commission, if you will, to be a prophet at this point, prior to this.
Yeah.
He was not.
And so it came in sort of a strange form, right? You know, he didn't get up, he didn't arise and baptize. He had a coal taken from the altar with tongs and touched to his mouth. Why note that the coal was taken with tongs?
Fire.
It's burning, right? It's burning. And so, do you think there's a reason it was a coal? Why use a coal touched to his lips as the thing that forgave his iniquity?
Fire purifies in the Old Testament.
Yeah. So he said fire purifies. And that actually we see that fire is a symbol of the holy, or fire is often associated with the holy. And there's a couple places we can look at to see that. So, Exodus 3, the burning bush, remember? It's not... Well... So, Exodus 3... All right, can somebody read the first 6 verses for us?
Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near here. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
So... God comes down and appears as a blazing fire, and what Moses is told is, this is holy ground. God is here, so holy and fire associated with each other. I'm going to have to move faster because I just caught sight of the clock. We see this again in Exodus 13. In Exodus 13, 21, right? The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So again, God and fire, or you know, represented by fire there. And then Exodus 19 again, verse 16. It came about on the third day when it was morning that there was thunder and lightning and flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp were trembling. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. So when God appeared on Mount Sinai, which this is right after the stuff we read earlier about protecting it because the holy God is there, it's fire. And then, remember the seraphim, or seraphim, however you want to say, we mentioned earlier? The literal translation of that word is burning ones. So some people even say that there's not a distinction between seraphim and cherubim, that seraphim is just, because it's that, I think Jeff said that word only occurs here. So he sees these burning ones attending to God. And so in that scene in Isaiah 6, you have the burning ones attending to God. A burning one takes a live coal off the altar that has to be carried with a tong, and that's what he touches to it. And then remember the day of Pentecost in Acts 2. What happened when the Holy Spirit...
Tongues of fire.
Tongues of fire. So, holy, and particularly the holiness of God, is regularly associated with or symbolized by fire. And part of that, like Cole said, has to do with purifying or refining. Like we get the image in the Bible of being refined like metals, which I have some experience with if you want to talk about that. that you really hot fire will melt down and purify metal, or in some cases it destroys the unholy that try and come into the presence of God. God's holiness and glory are similar concepts that are radiant like fire. God is described as light, which in the ancient world is much more strongly associated with light than in our fluorescent world. Fire and light sort of go hand in hand. And there are other ways that we can do that or think about that too. So Isaiah 6, we see the symbolism of fire and stuff coming along with the idea of holy bringing this burning coal. And so what happened once Isaiah was made clean by the coal?
He could speak to the Lord.
He could speak for the Lord.
Right. Well, I mean, now, so you pointed out earlier that the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out. But we're not told what it says. And it may be that he couldn't understand it, because it's only after the coal happens and the angel says that your iniquity is taken away that verse 8 says, "Then I heard the voice of the Lord. Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me." So what did becoming holy mean for Isaiah?
He became a vessel for God.
He had a job to do. And it would carry him through the rest of his life. He belonged to God in one sense now. And so now with the last 3 minutes of class, let's translate this a little bit. How is our situation like Isaiah's situation in chapter 6?
Well, it's us.
Right?
I'll take a quick swag at it. So there are two things in the New Testament, Old Testament, that seem to purify. One is water, the other is fire. Fire is used here in the case with Isaiah. For us, it's baptism. So by accepting that baptism, we are becoming a servant of God,
mm-hmm.
and we are no different in that regard than what Isaiah was.
Right.
At the moment that his lips were touched with that coal.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the correlation between the two, because both water and fire can purify, at least from God's perspective.
Right. What else is used to purify in the Old Testament? Can you think of something else?
Blood.
Remember when they're dedicating the tabernacle and the priests, they're consecrated with
blood.
So, do you see how this situation in Isaiah 6 runs so parallel to where we are now? Because we have the certainty of standing in the presence of God, and we don't want to say, "Woe is me," in that moment, because in that moment it will be too late. And so...
Well, to me, the more amazing thing is here, the holiest of holy wants a relationship with us who are unholy.
Right.
And so he goes out of his way, to bring the unholy into his presence,
mm-hmm.
and then make them holy so then they can accomplish his purposes, which he could accomplish 15 other ways, but this is the way he goes about it.
Mm-hmm. And you see that in Isaiah's story, that he was gracious to restrain the holiness, I guess, with the smoke or whatever, but gracious to send that angel to purify him and commission him into the work. He didn't just leave him to burn up in his presence, right? And so he's done the exact same for us. There's been he has gone out of his way to provide a way for us to be made clean so that we can then have the confidence to go into his presence. You want to say something?
Well, he always required a sacrifice. Like
right.
He said blood, but it was a sacrifice which Jesus did for us, and
mm-hmm.
now he says we are living epistles, living sacrifices unto God.
Absolutely. And
I mean, remember in Hebrews, you know, nothing is purified without blood. I'm looking right over it. It's in chapter 9. I know it's there. But and then, so we get to Hebrews 10, 19. We have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he inaugurated. And have a heart sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and bodies washed with pure water. So there you go. Thank you for a good class.